Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
The arrival of Sheba, the queen, but we're not talking about Queen Sheba today. Hi, this is Linda Palacio for A Taste of the Past on heritageradionetwork.com. Today we're going to be talking about queen bees, not Sheba the queen. And I would like to mention that Fairway is our sponsor today. Fairway markets are terrific. I know that many of you now are happy they're in your neighborhood. They're expanding and they have the freshest produce, great products, and hope that you will visit your local Fairway market. My guest today, talking about queen bees, is the queen of bee literature, I guess you might say, right now, Holly Bishop. Holly is a beekeeper, number one, we have to say, and a journalist, and the author of, I have to say, it's not a new book, it's been around for a while, right?
About five years.
The most fascinating book. It's called Robbing the Bees, and I think beekeeping is really in the news lately a lot. It's been around for millions of years, but it's really been in the news because the city has just passed an ordinance that is now legal to keep bees in the city. Finally, we are happy. I mean, usually you have to escape to the country to raise some bees. But Holly, first of all, welcome and thank you so much for writing this incredible book. I've always been fascinated with bees, but now this has really tipped the scale for me.
Thank you, Linda. I'm happy to be here.
What made you write the book? Well, how did you get into writing the book?
I was a woman of the city for most of my last 10 years and bought a house in the country and was trying to figure out what I could do, like start a garden or raise cows or something to do as a weekend farmer. And I went to visit my friend who kept bees, and that was it. He showed me what it was like to harvest honey and put it on your lips, like right in the apiary, and I was sold. And then I knew nothing about beekeeping or bees, so I just started from there, learned from scratch.
Well, I have to say, more than just learning about bees. I mean, this book is really contains scholarly research. I have to commend you on the research that you did. And I was so happy that it's indexed. I thought it was just going to be this nice little book about keeping bees, but I mean, it is really a compendium of knowledge about honey and beekeeping. Well, bees have been around for forever, but interesting. I'm going to let you talk about it. The history of honey. Honey, I mean, for millions of years, right?
Millions of years, millennia. Bees weren't around two millennia ago. But wasps were, and then flowering plants evolved, and bees evolved in order to collect nectar from those plants, because wasps are carnivores and bees are honeymakers. That's what they use to feed their brood. Mm-hmm. So honey came when bees did, about millennia ago.
Well, they refer to Mesopotamia, there's in the tablets, there's references to honey in recipes in the food in ancient Mesopotamia. So we know it was around there. Although some they say the land of milk and honey, but often the honey was mistaken for perhaps date syrup, and they weren't sure whether it was date syrup in some of the writings or honey. But the writings of the bees and the pictures of them, mm-hmm. certainly.
Well, I think honey was the only real sweetener for centuries. You could get sort of watered down sweetener from dates or mm-hmm. figs, but honey was pure and it was revered for that reason. There was nothing else like it. And it was used in, it was a luxury, but used in anything that needed a sweetener.
Well, I can see that having an interest in bees and raising them, suddenly for you became an obsession.
You can't help it. Every beekeeper I've met, and I understand there's one nearby coming on the
here
show.
Here at Roberta's, yeah. We'll talk to him later, yeah.
But everyone I've ever met, they describe this seduction. I mean, you just can't help but become obsessed.
I think that I was really surprised. You have some interesting facts in the book, and how little honey we as a nation, the U.S., consume, and hopefully that's changing. I mean, hundreds of pounds of sugar, but...
I think I remember it was 150 pounds of processed sugar that the average American eats in a year. Uh-huh. And by comparison, about 2 teaspoons of honey per week.
Well, so about a pound of honey a year or
half,
something, right?
Yeah.
Amazing. And it's such, I mean, having lived in Europe, I became introduced to a lot of different varieties of honey, which, I was uninformed before, so I didn't know. And all these different, the bitter honeys, the sweet honeys, depending on the flowers, right?
The flavors that you get in a honey result from which flowers the bees were foraging on to gather the nectar. So if they're in a field of clover, you're going to get a really sweet clover honey. I went to Australia to meet a beekeeper who made leatherwood honey. Have you ever tasted that?
No.
It's extraordinary. It's spicy and aromatic and dark. And that's because they gather the nectar from this rare leatherwood tree. And it's very specific flavors often.
The Corbezzolo plant, which is only found in the Mediterranean, makes a very bitter honey. And I found that in Italy, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. Didn't know the plant. Mm. And certainly didn't know the honey. But it's very... very sharply bitter,
like a manuka, more medicinal.
For example, but you would use it in foods, but it's great in a lot of savory dishes, mm-hmm. not necessarily for sweetening, or drizzled on a nice sharp sheep's milk cheese, mm-hmm. or fresh ricotta. I mean the uses of honey are only becoming reintroduced in this country. Why did we get away from it? I don't know.
I think the culprit is sugar, as we said. Sugar was, when it was first introduced in Europe, it was maybe the 11th century, and it was very expensive. It was a status symbol to have a little tablet of sugar in your purse. And then it became, there was cane sugar and then beet sugar. And there was lots and lots of sugar available, and everybody wanted sugar. And then suddenly honey was this boring old syrup.
Yeah,
so
I guess so.
We blame sugar.
I remember the honey would be dragged out, as you mentioned, one of the, and I'll talk about him, somebody that you interviewed in the book, mentioned honey curing sore throats and being used as a cough medicine. And that's when the honey was dragged out in my home when I was a child, was, if we had a cough, my mother would make the honey and lemon juice concoction and make us gargle or swallow that, and that was a great treat. But of course, honey was, because it became not as popular, it also then the price went up and honey was expensive. Mm-hmm. Honey's always been expensive. Mm-hmm. I mean, it takes a lot of bees and a lot of flowers.
Yes.
Like how many flowers? Something like I think millions of flowers?
2 million flowers that must be visited to make a pound of honey.
Wow. So, that was a rare thing, a rare treat as well, unless you kept your own bees, which was that popular.
Most people did. I mean, until sugar came around, then every farmstead would have, a hive or two of bees in the backyard. Because
for honey or for pollination, what do you think what was the main
reason? Honey, you could do, it was your household sweetener, it was the way you made your mead, which was the beverage of choice before wine came along. So it was very standard. You had a cow in the backyard, and somebody nearby had a beehive, and you could barter your if you didn't have a beehive, you would trade your cow's milk.
Well, I was intrigued by the title "Robbing the Bees," and then read the book and kind of understood. Explain how you chose that title.
That was, I struggled with what to call this book, and then one day the character of my nonfiction book is a beekeeper who I interviewed and spent a lot of time with in the Florida Panhandle, and he is a real character.
Don Smiley.
Don Smiley. His name is really Don Smiley. And he just had all these funny sayings. And but he'd say, let's go rob those bees, because that's how beekeepers describe it. They are taking gently the honey that the bees have produced for their own consumption.
Well, reading the history that you include in the book, I was fascinated by the fact that people have been robbing the bees for, as you say, millennium. I mean, mm-hmm. a million years. And so there are evidences even 6,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, of the cave paintings of people gathering the hives. But they were really robbing the bees, because they didn't know about keeping extra honey in there to feed the rest of the brood. I mean, they would kill off the bees and just take the honey.
Right. It was a much more sort of violent
rob and pillage.
Robbing, yes. And then a lot of the research in the book is about how that process evolved when people learned husbandry, if you will, of bees, that you could grow your hive at the same time as taking excess honey.
Right. And can you kind of pinpoint a time when, let's say, cultivation of hives and honey evolved?
It was a long process that really changed rapidly in the 19th and 20th centuries with innovations in the hives. Like the hives that I saw on the roof at Roberto's.
Here at Roberto's, yeah.
Are the result of an invention that was able to identify how much space the bees needed between frames. And that might sound like a very small innovation, but when they could determine that amount of space, it means you could take the frames out and manipulate the hive and get all the honey out as often as you wished.
Mm-hmm.
So that
but,
was huge.
But they were, but I mean, as far as, I guess they weren't actually, well, they were cultivating. I mean, even in the 12th century and earlier in the 600s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the basket hives.
Right. Those things you always see and wonder why is that a beehive? It's
right.
Because those were called skeps, and they were made out of straw.
And those are not used anymore because they weren't, as you say, you couldn't pull out the frames and separate the comb?
I think there were just better materials when, mm-hmm. When the timber industry had the equipment to actually make nice plywood board and mass produce beehives, that changed the whole skep market.
right, indeed. Well, actually, they would, I mean, I know that they would not touch the queen, right, and leave her alone. They knew enough about that. Although
I think a lot of it was reaching into a hole in a tree or a skep and taking out the outside comb and hoping that they didn't get stung too much and hoping that the queen was still in there. But the science of the queen wasn't really understood until probably the 18th century.
Interesting. And a lot of people who became obsessed as well, like as you did. Was it Longstroth? Who's
Lorenzo Longstroth?
Lorenzo Longstroth.
He's the guy that invented or that discovered that tiny little space between the frames.
So, and that's where our modern hives evolved
mm-hmm,
from
mm-hmm,
that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Eva Crane, a scientist, I mean, wrote, just did a massive amount of research.
Amazing, amazing. The book is, 4 inches thick, and she just got as much lore and history as is possible, I think.
And lore abounds, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
there are stories of Aristotle's and people thinking that honey was the rain that came from the gods,
mm-hmm.
right?
I think Aristotle was one of the first to apply more scientific methods, but before that, people saw bees on flowers gathering nectar, and they assumed that nectar had rained down from the gods because it was such a valued, product, the sweet nectar.
And so. the golden color like the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And
so they gave thanks to the rain and the gods every time. And
interesting. And well, talk about Don Smiley. You knew you didn't know enough about beekeeping, right? And you thought it would be best if you saw it firsthand?
Yes, and I knew that it would be much more interesting to have someone besides, excuse me, me talking about my beekeeping forays and foibles. And I write a lot about my own mistakes as a beginning beekeeper, but Smiley has been doing it for 10 years, and he was a real professional and brought a lot of color
So he let you come down to Florida and follow him around.
He tried to put me to work, but I was busy scribbling in my notebooks. But yeah, I followed him around for about three years to just get every part of the process.
Well, now being the panhandle, his specialty is, of course, Tupelo honey.
The Tupelo,
right?
Yes.
Super sweet honey. And well, and interesting, because when you get these specialized honeys, I mean, it's, you figure the blossoming time, it's a very short period of time. So you've got to make hay quickly, right?
You do.
Honey quickly.
I was surprised at how, like, I'm sorry, in my home, I had several different kinds of flowers and just collected them all at once. So I made wildflower honey. But Smiley has very specific buds that he gathers from, so he moves them as the...
Moves a hive, bees and all.
Moves them from flower to flower, or not flower to flower, individually.
Field to field.
So before the Tupelo, it's something called red gallberry. And then when the gallberry's done, the Tupelo blossoms open, and it can be like a week-long scramble to get all of that nectar before the blossoms go away.
So how many harvests has he... do in a season?
He does about four different honeys, and then moves them all up north to stay a little bit warmer during the winter.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really physical job, which I didn't understand before. I mean, it's such hard work just lifting and moving hives around.
And you did a wonderful job of documenting that, and some interesting stories and tales to tell along the way. How many hives do you have up in? You have a home up in Connecticut and out in the country.
I had two until a bear came.
Uh-huh.
Now I have none.
Winnie the Pooh. Oh no!
No, you can't. When a bear finds out where that kind of snack is, they'll come back over and over and over again. And yeah. I didn't have enough property to move the hives far enough away, so I'm no longer a beekeeper.
But when you were harvesting your honey, when you were keeping the bees, how did you get one harvest of honey? Or
I had three hives, and I think my best yield from one of those hives was about 150 pounds.
Wow.
And I might have done that over the course of a fall harvest. So I almost always ended up with way too much honey. I still have a garage full.
So you wait till the end of the season if you have small hives and small production, or do you take the frames out regularly and
depends
reap
on
it?
What you know. Exactly. If you're gathering a certain kind of flower, then you would go right in the middle of the season. But I generally waited until my supers, which are where the honey is collected, I waited until those got full, and then I would harvest.
Well, it was knowing about different types of honeys from different plants and flowers. And then reading about Don Smiley's, you know, wait for the Tupelo honey, I was interested to find out the fact that you brought up that each time a bee leaves the hive, they stick with only one kind of flower. That is fascinating. I mean, I just, you know, I look in my garden, I see bees all around, I think, well, they're going from flower to flower to flower. No, if it's a daisy, it's only daisies, right? If it's clover, it's only clover.
Yes. I mean, researching this book and beekeeping, there were so many times where I just was like, that's not possible. It's so amazing.
They haven't learned about varietal mixes?
Nope. But that also plays into the whole pollination puzzle, because that's how plants get cross-pollinated by bees, because they are going from the same flower and bringing pollen that's stuck to them from one flower to the next.
And
it's
so consequently
amazing.
We have beautiful crops of flowers.
Right.
Well, and a problem too in heirloom vegetables. I was talking to a woman about growing heirloom varieties, and you have to be careful about cross-pollinization, let's say with melons or squash or something, and because that will occur. They're similar flowers, but different types of a plant. Interesting. And the Tupelo was the sweet honey, and that only is in blossom for a week or two.
It could be as little as a week or 10 days, and sometimes it might be 3 weeks. But it's a really short season, and it's a tree that grows only in that part of the country, and I think maybe in a couple of other places in the world. So that's why he can charge a premium for it. It's rare. It's got a very distinct flavor.
And highly sought after, right. Well, we're going to talk more about the bees when we come back after this short break.
You can to take all the tea in China. Put it in a big brown bag for me. Sail right around all the seven oceans. Drop it straight into the deep blue sea. She's as sweet as Tupelo, honey. She's an angel of the first degree. She's as sweet. She's as sweet as Tupelo, honey. Just like honey, baby, from the blue. You can't stop us on the road to freedom. You can't keep us, cause our eyes can see. Men within sight, men in granite. Knights in armor bent on chivalry. Of the first degree.
She's an angel.
She's as sweet as Tupelo, honey. Just like honey, baby, from the bee.
Welcome back to A Taste of the Past. I'm talking with Holly Bishop about bees and honey, and which is older than history, right? Mm-hmm. And we have just been joined in the studio by Brandon Hoy and Eddie Diaz. Welcome, guys. They are, aside from Brandon being part owner of Roberta's Restaurant, where we record our shows from, they are the master beekeepers here in on the rooftops of Roberta's. And Holly, we were talking about the problems in the country with beekeeping and the hives, and Holly lost her hives to a bear.
Oh, man. We don't have
that. Wow.
You guys are safe.
We're safe from bears, thankfully.
Right. So, but what are some of the challenges that you face as city beekeepers?
I mean, we've only lost two hives. One of them was because of the cold weather and the wind on top of a six-story building where we keep our hives. So it's a little colder, and you get a pretty killer breeze coming across. I lost our first hive to foul brood, which just based on like the type of bees that you get, and we were very inexperienced when we first got our first sets of hives.
We were YouTube beekeepers.
Okay. YouTube beekeepers.
I see Holly shaking her head. Holly, you're shaking everything. Your head.
You've just foul brood. It's exactly how it sounds.
Yeah, it is foul, and it smells bad. And you spend the money up front to kind of get the things you need, and then right away you just lose it all. None of it's reusable. I mean, once you've had foul brood in a the Langstroth style hive, it's done pretty much.
Yeah, we just talked about Lorenzo a little while ago, as a matter of fact.
The history of beekeeping.
Yeah, you bet. But what I wanted to know is, well, first of all, we're only recently just allowed legally. I know you guys have been doing it for a little while, but. We're in here in the city. An ordinance has been passed that does allow city dwellers to keep beehives. Realizing they had to make people realize that bees weren't bad; they're not culprits, right? But what made you start keeping bees here in the city?
It was kind of it was as much of a hobby that we were kind of getting into as friends at the beginning, because our third partner, who's not here right now, John Feldman, who is the general manager over at Frankie Spuntino on 457 Court, he went to culinary school. He went to the CIA upstate, and he was turned on to beekeeping by a professor. And then we talked about it. I worked with John over at Oto and Ateca, and we talked about beekeeping, and we didn't know where we were going to do it. At the time, we were like, we could get a car, we could do it in Long Island, we could do it in Pennsylvania maybe, get some land and do it. Not just ignoring exactly where we were and what we could actually do here. And then with Roberta's, once I started working here, and then Brandon had all these like plans that were just then at the beginning. It was only plans, and they're moving fast on them, but for rooftop farming, and you know this idea of agriculture on top of the buildings, which to us we were like, oh wow, that is perfect.
It's a very symbiotic relationship between the
restaurant,
urban agriculture, and kind of beekeeping, right, both for the pollination and just for
well, the that's fact what of that's the, that was my question, because just I remind the listeners, I've mentioned it before, but Roberta's restaurant has phenomenal gardens on top of the roof as well as in the back, and now a new venture in, is it Long Island City?
Yeah, Long Island City, the Brooklyn Grange, which is 40,000 square feet of
rooftop gardens.
Yeah,
so
and
I wonder,
it's very diverse, you know, as far as the type of produce that's grown there.
That's so. Why I wondered if maybe you started keeping the bees for pollination because of the
like you said, it kind of started as a hobby. We were more just interested in beekeeping and just the idea of like going through this process and like learning about the bees, and it gave us some time together, the three of us, to kind of just like have this project and work on it. And we started very small, and now we have 7 hives in Brooklyn. And it's just like kind of a growing relationship with the bees themselves and with us.
Yeah.
Amazing.
It's funny because what we originally started doing was looking at YouTube, looking, you know, Beekeeping for Dummies, books like this that are actually extremely helpful, especially YouTube as a resource for somebody to teach themselves. And as we started researching things, we realized that there are tons of people beekeeping, even when it was illegal, beekeeping in New York City.
Well, so there's a whole organization of city beekeepers.
Absolutely. Yeah. And just like par for the course for us, we decided not to really have anything to do with the organization itself, just kind of do our own thing. But
we liked to be like outlaws in the beginning. We kind of liked the whole, like, you know, it was illegal and we were doing it DIY.
Okay, so everyone out there is wondering, Holly, you included, okay, you're in the country doing this, and she was a newbie too, and you were learning on the fly. How many times have you been stung?
Oh, I've been stung a lot. I'm probably get stung the most. They, for some reason, I have kind of an outdated hairstyle, a mullet, and they like the back of my neck. They get stuck in my hair always. So you can see I have my hair up right now. So I have to. This is like
don't
a new
wear
thing.
A veil or anything?
You know, it just depends on what kind of work we're doing.
Gloves.
If we're in the hive a lot, and we're really like messing with frames, or we're going down into like brood boxes, we're usually a lot more cautious. Just overall maintenance and looking through and just kind of looking for things, diagnostic,
showing our friends. You know, people
we're a little less careful sometimes.
Yeah. And Holly, I know you mentioned that
I couldn't count the
ventures.
Number of times I've been stung.
Yeah.
But I tend to wear gloves. And
I've never really had a bad reaction till the last time I got stung on my hand it swole up like 3 times its normal size. It was huge. And it lasted for like 3 days.
Ah, but it's worth the honey.
Yeah, and it's good for your arthritis, apparently.
Yeah, which, apparently, right. I don't
know. I'm fighting early here.
I actually, when we put in this year's colonies, we were with a photographer from I guess the Huffington Post food page, and we were up there doing our thing in front of him. We only had one suit here. John Feldman was wearing the suit, so I had everything tucked in, you know, my jeans tucked in my boots. It was pretty cold, so I had a jacket on and my shirt tucked into my jeans, things like that, and I had a veil and gloves, so I figured I was fine. I did have one small hole in my jeans.
Oh, and they
in
found
a place
it.
where guys generally get holes in the jeans, which is dead center of the stitching, I would say, at the top of the legs.
The crotch area,
yes.
We can say that.
And, yeah, man, I actually, on camera, got stung in the family jewels.
Oh, so,
yeah. That really happened.
Well, isn't honey a good salve for that?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's true.
Oh, that's incredible. What about your harvest of honey? Are you successful in... How much do you get?
This year, I think that we're having a little bit of problem with the kind of excluder it almost seems that we're using to keep the queen down in the lower brood chambers. the bees really do that naturally. And I think we're going to try taking the excluders off, or at least that's what John and I were talking about, that they're not building as much on the top levels as they did last year. I think that there's, we're kind of learning still, and like the metal excluders might be a little bit more successful than the plastic ones. But last year we had one hive that produced a ton of honey.
I mean, we have one hive that's not here at Roberta's that produces
enormous.
It's an enormous hive, and it's constantly producing.
Is it over at the Grange by any chance?
No, this is one that we have in Williamsburg, which it's our biggest hive, and we have to move it.
Oh.
It needs to be moved. It needs to be moved like in the next month or so. So we're going to have to. This will be our first full hive transportation.
Holly, do you have any helpful hints after following Don Smiley around?
Well, there's a stuff called Bee-Gon. Have you looked into that? It's butyric acid, and it's just foul, foul smelling. But that's more for
eliminating them from an area. Yeah, we want to actually capture the hive and move it. I mean, I think what we're going to do in the end is probably like pheromone style stuff. Get Brandon in a bee beard.
Yeah, I'll just walk through Brooklyn with a giant bee beard.
Good publicity.
Yes, why not?
The bees go into the hive at night when it's cool and dark, and you could cover them in plastic. It wouldn't be as exciting.
That's kind of like, I mean, I've seen Andrew move them before. I've seen it secondhand.
Andrew Cote.
I've seen that method.
It's surprisingly traumatic to the hive to move them. I was so shocked by we had to move
one very short distance.
Dude, like 25 feet or something, maybe 40 feet we moved it. And then it seems that the bees from those colonies that we moved flew out the next day and then went back to their previous spot, which is where the other hives were. Oh. And then those hives got much bigger, much quicker, before that they could possibly have reared brood. So that's really what happened. They just got lost going back.
Maybe there were bees from that hive that you moved away.
It's possible.
Maybe.
If they weren't all back in their respective hives at night.
It's possible. We moved them at night.
Mm.
So, I mean, we had figured that most of them were already back. And it seemed full. They were a fairly new hive, so
2 days.
Yeah, 2 days. I mean, there was probably only 30,000 bees in there.
Maybe they weren't even settled in yet. Yeah. They weren't. Yeah.
So, I mean, they probably had just figured out what their flight path was, you know.
Yeah.
And then it's got to be a little confused. Then the bear. Then the big bears
the
big came.
Bear, the human bear.
Human right. bear, man.
Well, a friend of mine upstate decided to start some hives, and she became obsessed, as we talked about earlier. And I thought, oh, it's just because she needed a good hobby. But after reading this book and then hearing your tale, I'm hooked. I mean, it is. I can see how easily it can become an obsession. Problem is, I do have bears up on my upstate property, so I'm a little worried about that. But she said, once you see bees swarm, it's a sight that, I mean, you've never seen before. Have you had swarms? We haven't had our own swarm.
I've seen a swarm, but we haven't had our own swarm yet. We're fairly confident if they do swarm, which we take all precautions to make sure that they don't, giving them enough room, enough, you know, air circulation. But besides that, if they do, I think we're fairly confident in being able to go after them.
Holly, can you describe a swarm, those of us who don't know what a swarm is? When bees swarm, it's not necessarily a good thing.
No, it's that, as we just heard, their home has become unlivable for some reason, or the queen has abandoned or died.
Jump ship.
It's bees in need of a home and a leader. And so it's usually at the end of a season. It might be 50,000 bees, and they're all flying together it's like a cloud, a big humming cloud, vibrating. And then they'll find a place to settle and regroup.
Hopefully it's a place that's easy to get to.
Yeah.
And not like in somebody's attic.
But you can guide the swarm sometimes successfully.
If you can find the queen, a lot of times you can just move them.
She's usually somewhere in there.
She's usually dead center.
If it's a problem where the queen is gone, then it's a little bit more difficult. They make pheromone type traps for them that you can put out and try to catch the swarm, which we've never used, so I don't know what the success rate is on something like that, but they exist.
So each hive is one queen and how many thousands of bees generally?
It could be up to 100,000. It just depends on what size the colony is and how strong they are.
I mean,
I think an average in a Langstroth hive is 70,000-80,000, mm-hmm. and that's primarily worker bees, which is what you see out collecting nectar.
Females.
And then there are
maybe 2,000 drones. Yeah. It's a small percentile.
And we'll kick those out the door usually.
They can't fly.
Yeah, pretty sure they just
definitely bite off their wings and throw them out at the end of the season.
Right. Yeah. They're pretty lazy. I think if they had like chairs, they'd probably just sit around and do nothing.
Yeah, right. They also buzz very loudly but cannot sting in the male bees.
Interesting. Yeah.
And they take up a lot of the resources of the hive.
Yeah.
Well, that's just it. I mean, we talked about the title of Holly's book, Robbing the Bees. But of course, now in more modern day cultivation, we to leave at least one super there for food for the bees, so they'll make it through the winter, right? Mm-hmm. And you don't take all their food away.
We take very little right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first season we tried not to take anything. We were very much like, we need to build the colonies and let them know that like what they're building homes for themselves that they're gonna like hopefully stay in for.
In the end, it was too cold of a winter, and I think that's how we lost the one hive, that we left too much food. We left an extra shallow super on top as well, so they would have extra food,
which gave it more space, which gave it
they had to heat
a bigger area than what they could. So.
Mm.
Our generosity
might have killed our bees.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting that the process of the honey making, which you describe beautifully in the book, and how it's what percentage of liquid water it is when it's first made.
Well, it starts out it's plant nectar, and it's
the pellets of
99% water, and then the bees bring it in the quantities we were talking about, just drop by drop into the hive, and they actually fan it with their wings to dry it
to evaporate all
the
that
moisture.
Water.
Yeah.
Wow, that is what a process. I'm making maple
reduction.
Syrup. I know is the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. So, but I could use some bees for that.
It's incredible. I mean, they do that. They do that to perfection every time. They cure it, and they only cap when it's completely like impossible to go rancid, you know.
Cap meaning they cap off the comb and they don't use anymore.
Once they're completely satisfied with what they have, then it's done and they cap it. And like you said, there's it's like 100% on every time.
So they're the combs amazing. Once the combs are filled with honey and that's it, they're not reusable. They're done.
No, they're reusable. That was another invention where you take that cap off and you spin it around and the honey spins out and you can put the wax comb right back in.
But the wax is so usable, friendly, and functional.
But also, it helps the bee, to make them go through the process of rebuilding. Just it gives them this like extra amount of time that you have to like go through to like nurse them and be like, all right, now we're giving you back empty frames and now you have to rebuild again. Whereas if you just put the frame back in with the comb, it's like they just go back to work doing the same thing, filling the comb up, putting more honey in. Usually if you want to use the wax and stuff, it comes from a hive that's either died,
gone,
or if you're taking supers off permanently, then you can use that wax, that bee pollen, the propolis, all the byproduct of it is usable.
Well, it was interesting to learn that the ancient Greeks used the comb, the wax, the beeswax, for their lost wax sculptures.
Wow.
And reductions. And my friend upstate who does it, she now uses it for jewelry making. She uses the gone, spent honeycomb for some silver making, which is all these byproducts of bees that are just so wonderful. What would we do without them, right?
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah. And, well, I mean, food, first of all, food, which is, I mean, you found out you can survive on honey alone for a while, right?
There are tribes in Africa that do just that.
Well, and the other thing that was so intriguing to me, there's so much information in this book, we could go on for hours, and then getting, the firsthand experience from you guys. But I was so interested to learn that their bees were not in North America. They are not indigenous to North America. They had to be imported. We didn't have bees in this new country until the country was founded in 1600s, mm-hmm. right?
And now we export as well.
Really?
And there's places like New Zealand, I believe, that
they don't. Their bees are not indigenous in New Zealand either.
Well, I mean, any place that does like monocropping type of farming needs pollination. So mm-hmm. usually they'll bring in, you know, billions of bees. You know, thousands of actual
like semis full
filled with bees.
Yeah,
to pollinate.
Well, that was a thing that I had to laugh at. I mean, you get your bees delivered in the mail, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you get a queen in a package.
And I have to imagine that the people at the mail at USPS are pretty used to it by now. they never seem very shook up about it when you're like, we're here to get our bees. They're like, oh, yeah, they're so cute.
Oh, that's interesting. And of course, the fear is you don't kill the bees. Be careful of the bees. Whereas in ancient times, we've talked about, they killed the bees just to get the honey, and then so
yeah,
they do.
Langstroth Hive was a huge. That's what's funny is it's looked at now as not the most. I don't want to use the word humane because you're talking about different things, but it's not the most natural state for like bees to like actually what they would normally do is form a circle.
You're right, left on their own, they would make up
right.
their own hive.
But it was originally designed so that you could actually save the colony. You could overwinter the colony because you're just taking the honey out and putting the frames right back in. So that it's just funny to think of now that we have this guy Ron Braylon who taught us a lot about beekeeping. He's an impressive guy, and he has like a really good mind for all kinds of farming. But he particularly with the bees, he does incredible stuff. Like he builds his own hive, like the dodecahedron.
Huh. Which is like it's natural. They can form the colony kind of in their natural shape, which is more of like a what's the word? It's like a looks like a football almost. It's like this oval shaped type
beautiful
structure that they build. So he then just kind of builds that shape for them out of the dodecahedron box, and then they naturally build the shape house they want,
which then perfect. He can open it up and like get inside to like diagnose if there's any kinds of problems or whatever, but you can't in his extract. Design you can't extract honey.
No, you can't.
No, they build
so it's
their
for
own
research
comb.
Basically
research and farming and like having
pollinators
in the world.
Well, if it weren't for the bees, we wouldn't have flowers and all that great food and medicine. I mean, what the medicinal qualities are wonderful.
There's probably thousands of tinctures.
Yes, indeed. From. And I mean, there's so much information. We could go on for another hour of this book, but I encourage you to read Robbing the Bees by Holly Bishop. And thank you so much, Brandon and Eddie, for joining us and giving us all that firsthand information. And I'd also like to thank our producer, Jack Inslee, and our engineer, Nat Wiener, and Fairway Market for being our sponsor. I'm Linda Palacio. You've been listening to A Taste of the Past.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.